Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, precisionhydration.com.
Precision Hydration offer electrolyte drinks in different strengths to match how you sweat. Personalize your hydration strategy today at precisionhydration.com and get a free box or tube of pH worth up to $9.99 using the code OXYGENADDICT.
We're also brought to you by teamoxygenaddict.com triathlon coaching.
Helping hundreds of age group triathletes see huge improvements in their 70.3 and Ironman performances. The Time Training System makes sure that you get the important training done each week in a way that complements the rest of your life.
I'm also brought to you by FueledByCake.com.
That's my charity cake recipe book with loads of yummy cake recipes, some of which you can shove into your back pocket. Recipes from the likes of Chrissy Wellington, Laura Siddle, Rachel Joyce, Emma Pooley, Rob's Nan, and loads of others. You can get yours at fueledbycake.com for just £10.
Do you know, Hells, just the other day in the Facebook group, somebody posted that they were going to try my Nan's Dayton Walnut Cake and looked at the calendar and it was the anniversary of her dying. How sweet is that?
Well, you see, it's meant to be sometimes,
little,
isn't it?
I had a little, Nan's Dayton Walnut Cake, bless her.
Honestly, sometimes these things are meant to be. No, we got Lee Jordan posted a little note saying that he had also been struggling to wake up in the mornings and then said, "Fueled by more cake is awesome. I love the probably the best chocolate loaf cake and the chocolate courgette loaf cake, as do my colleagues and friends. Going to bake Rob's Nan's cake this week, so looking forward to that."
Bless him. The morning's getting lighter. I was out for a run this morning before we were recording and the sun was rising and it was bang on 8 o'clock as the sun came over the horizon. Blue sky, not a cloud there. Freezing cold. It was just beautiful. So we were saying, weren't we, it's getting lighter in the evenings and now it's getting lighter in the mornings as well. Spring's on the way. Yes.
Yes. I can't wait for the day when I come out of the pool or the gym and it is light again. That always makes me smile.
What time are you coming out of the gym in the moment?
About 7:10.
So it's a couple of weeks away yet, isn't it? Still.
Yeah. Still a little bit longer. So yeah, get there in the pitch dark at sort of 6 and then shower out, but still dark.
Love it. Yes. All right. Shall we jump in and do some results? We've had some racing going on this week, haven't we?
I know. Yes, there has been racing going on. 70.3 South Africa, Rob, was happening. And precisionhydration.com, new athlete, announced this just before the race as well. Emma Pallant was in action. And
they're sponsoring her now.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. And she had a good result, right?
She did. She had a very good result. She came second behind Anna Watkinson, and then Jade Roberts was in third. I know that there are only 4 pro women, Rob, on that start list, which is always a bit of a shame, I think. But Anna and Emma were very close together coming out of the sort of fairly close coming out the swim, and then onto the bike they came off quite close to each other. And then Anna was in the lead on the run. Emma went ahead and then Anna went back in front and went on to finish 2 minutes clear. So Anna finished in 4:21 with Emma in 4:23.
Good old ding-dong battle, hey?
Yes, I think so.
Over in the men's race, we had Bradley Weiss from South Africa take out ahead of Matt Troutman and James Kanama. Right, so other results we've got going on. We had the Triathlon England National Duathlon Championships, which were, hang on, I've got the wrong screen up here, Hells. Where the hell does it? Ashridge.
Ashridge. So it was the in Ashridge. And I tell you, Rob, the sort of podium photos of everyone looks a little bit colder than South Africa. They're all there with sort of like gloves and then like down jackets. I think all the women have got hats on. 2 of them have got like hats on. Oh, just looking really, really cold. Yes. But they all look, looks like typical sort of British winter duathlon.
It's not the kind of day you want to be hanging around, even if you're on the podium, is it? Can we just take the photo then we can go home?
Yeah.
All right, so on the ladies' side, we had a win for Victoria Kenny, and then Laura Addy in second and Sophie Bubb in third.
And the men's race was won by Ben Price, who said, "Dead chuffed to win the National Duathlon Champs today, both my age group and the overall title." So yeah, and he's flying at the moment. He's got a very good coach as well. So yeah, he won in 2:03 ahead of Daniel Jenkin and then Alex Doherty in third.
And the classic early season Ironman opener or Iron Distance opener of Isra Man. I can't even say it, Hells. Isra Man was open this year. It always sounds like it should be a warm race, but it always is chuffing freezing on race day morning, isn't it? So there's a full distance race and a half distance race going on this year. So in the full distance race, we had wins for Christian Alstadt from Germany and Antonia Reznikov of Israel, with England's or Britain's Paris Edwards in second place. Were you saying that was her final
pro race? Yep.
So she's retiring, is she? She's pulling the pin.
She is. She's retiring. I think her final Ironman, I want to say, was Malaysia. And I know she had a she was really disappointed with her race there. So I'm glad that she could go out to Isra Man and have, you know, and finish sort of on the podium. But yeah, that will be her final final pro race. And I just remember, Rob, a couple of years ago we were mentioning her almost like week in, week out. She was doing a lot of races in Southeast Asia and just absolutely ripping up the form book there. So yeah, fantastic, and such a lovely person as well.
Good for you. Congratulations on a great career, Paris. And so just a final shout out from our sponsors, precisionhydration.com. Get yourself to their online sweat test if you've not done it already, and check out using the results of their online questionnaire whether you are a particularly heavy or salty sweater. If that's the case, then you can get an in-person sweat test done with them, which is completely painless and takes about half an hour and will tell you your exact sweat rate. And it will also tell you the concentration of sodium in your sweat. So typically, if you suffer from cramps a lot, or if you find yourself really struggling in very hot races and feeling ill after the race, sodium is probably the issue. For all of us training indoors at this time of year, keeping on top of our electrolytes is really important, because if you're inside on a hot turbo trainer, you're going to be losing an awful lot of electrolytes, much more so than you're going to be able to replace just through standard eating. So check it out over at precisionhydration.com. They've got what I consider to be the best electrolyte supplements on the market. Completely tasteless. Mix into a drink really nicely and will keep those cramps at bay and keep your electrolytes nice and topped up. And remember, you can get £9.99 worth as a free sample using the code OXYGENADDICT. Next thing we've got to mention is thanks to everyone who's left a review of the show on iTunes. It's been another great week, hasn't it?
People keep on leaving very nice things, Rob.
Yeah, so thanks very much to all of you who've done that. We've had, I think we had another 12 five-star reviews this week, taking us up to 152 five-star reviews. Now, I've bored you with this before, but it's dead important for us because that's how we get shown on iTunes. If someone searches for Triathlon Podcast, you get ranked on the basis of how many five-star reviews you've got. So we were aiming to try and get 200 by the end of January. We've got 4 days left, Hells, to get 48 reviews in. I don't know whether that's going to happen, but we had over 3,000 downloads of the last show. So there's people out there, please get on iTunes and do it for us if you can, because as a thank you, if you leave us a five-star review and you enter a screenshot on our Triathlon Facebook page, the OATC group on Facebook, you're going to get entered into a prize draw to win a copy of that beautiful coffee table book of the Cervelo story, which is called To Make Athletes Faster by Anna DiPiccio. We had them on the show last week, Anna and founder Phil White. So it's an amazing story of starting the Cervelo brand. And so if you're not already a member, join the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Community Facebook page, take a screenshot of your review from iTunes, pop it up in there. I'm going to be doing a prize draw at the end of this week. It'll just be a names from the hat kind of deal. And we'll announce the winner next week. And let's see how close we can get to the magic 200, Hells.
Fingers crossed. I did listen to, I didn't quite get all the way through the interview with Anna and Phil, but I did start on it, Rob. And I think I just got distracted, which is why I couldn't quite finish it at the time. But they were great fun at the beginning.
Yeah, good laugh, the pair of them.
Yeah, very funny. So yeah, that's the bits I heard I enjoyed, and I will finish it at some point.
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to the people who've left a review this week. So we had smartphonesoft.com, bit of spam there, like that. Nat Dunk, Try SH Willie, CPW Try, I Larkins, Someone called Massage Me. Interesting. Donald Brooks, Try, Ross Mc123, and Alan Garfish. Thanks all very much for leaving reviews to the podcast this week. We really appreciate it. Right, Hells, we've got an interview this week. It's a stonker, isn't it? Please tell us all about it.
Well, I couldn't stop talking.
No change there then.
No. So this week's interview of the week is with Joel Filial, who is one of the world's best triathlon coaches at the moment. He's coaching the likes of Mario Moller and Vincent Louis and Non Stanford and Katie Zafiras, and they are all in his crew, which is the JFT crew, which means just effing train. Quite like that. But no, really, really insightful. He's got a fascinating mix of experience working for federations. So he worked with Triathlon Canada, he worked with British Triathlon, he's now working for the Italian Triathlon Federation, and he's also got his sort of private setup, the private coaching group. So he really has got experience of both. So it's like best of both worlds for him. He's been there, he's done it, he's worked with so many of the top athletes in the sport. So he's got some good things to say, some fascinating things to say, and it'll make you think a little bit about some of the mistakes that we make as well as age groupers. So yeah, it's a good interview. So here we are. Here is this week's interview of the week. Joel Filial, hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. I don't think you need a massive introduction because you host your own podcast, The Real Coaching Podcast, and you are one of the best triathlon coaches in the world, and you're in Fuerteventura at the moment, right?
Yes, thanks for having me, and yeah, we're in at the Playtest Resort in Fuerteventura.
And how is life with the JFT crew?
Good. It's day after day. We're in for a long block here. We're doing 2 months here this year. And for some of them, we're also here in December. So we're getting very comfortable with the trails and the roads.
And is that normal to have a sort of a 2 month block?
Yes. Sometimes we move, but we generally don't really have an interruption in between. But our season kind of starts in the training season starts in December, and we do 2 or 3 weeks then, and then have a break over Christmas, and then we typically go straight through to the first World Series. And so that's what we're doing this year. Last year we moved venues, but we just rode, went down the road on the island. This year we're staying put, as Abu Dhabi is our first kind of big race, and so that's actually a week later, so we get more training time this year.
And so far, so good?
So far, so good. We've got a good group here. We're trying to keep some variety, but inevitably it's day after day, eat, sleep, train, and a similar pattern. But we kind of go through January building up a certain pattern of sessions, and then we kind of switch over a little bit middle February prior to when we go off and race. So we have some change then.
And talk us through the crew at the moment. I mean, you've got a pretty impressive stable of athletes there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should start by saying my primary job now, my primary role, I work for the Italian Federation as a performance director. And in part, what we tried to do there was really kind of bring the best of the world to Italy and to Italian athletes. So that's a big part of my job. I was in Rome on the weekend for a meeting and generally looking to create kind of really good environments and better environments for Italian athletes. And then I kind of joke, but the side project that's continued since about the London Games is this. International group, and I've been really fortunate that this is I've had so many opportunities to work with great athletes, and it's kind of grown. I guess success breeds success and more interest, and And we've really got an amazing group. I mean, from, I don't know if your listeners how closely they follow ITUs, but the obviously Mario Mola, the now three-time world champion, and Vincent Louis from France joined us middle way through last year. Obviously a great pedigree, but he was able to win the final again, and Jake Birtwistle on the third place of the series and from Australia, and then I mean we have many more, but on the women's side we also had Katie Zafaris, who won the closely fought silver medal against Vicky, but yeah, obviously super athlete and many more as well.
How do you ensure that, you know, they don't beast each other day in, day out when they're training?
That's a good thought. You know, like, you know, it's sort of a natural, I think, that you think that they would be tempted to do that. But I think our culture and the way that I think about things is really about kind of self-discipline and control. And we're not about kind of pushing as hard as possible, and we actively discourage that because it would be potentially counterproductive. You know, that what makes these guys good is getting to the start line healthy, with energy, and in the right space for themselves individually, and we don't need them to push each other too much in that way. I mean, definitely they help each other, but I think helping each other comes as much from kind of participating in the daily environment and supporting each other kind of every day. It's not just to go faster. So probably people don't maybe not think that, you know, they think, oh, well, we've got these great men or great women pushing each other, but the pushing each other part, we try to avoid too much. I think it's more supporting each other day to day. You know, when you show up and you're tired, and then there's someone else that can help carry the load that day, and that's where I think the success comes from, or where how I think about things anyway is that consistency over time, and it's not a single session. So when we've had athletes that wanted to push each other in the past, sometimes I separate them instead of encouraging that. Because I don't want them to leave their best races in training, and we don't want to set any PBs in training. And you know, again, it's maybe counterintuitive in a way, but I think that's really important, that ability to self-manage and be under control and disciplined. I mean, to the athletes, I probably sound like a broken record. Are we under control? Is, you know, how is the pace? And in focusing on those things, it's not just going harder all the time.
When you are working in a group environment, how do you individualize their training to ensure that, you know, each athlete is at their best?
A lot of the training we do is the same for everyone. Just gone through every week, I go through the same process of, especially on camp, it's not so hard because we're all here, but planning the week for each one. And there are some differences, although probably 90% of it is the same. But, you know, a lot of it depends on the running, really, like how much running they can do, what's the volume they can do. That's probably where there's the most difference, because it has such an impact on health and, you know, and biomechanics, like how much can they do and keep healthy. So it depends their individual history. So I pay attention a lot to that. So we've got variations on running frequency and volume and the volume of the main sessions. Some of the ones that swim faster, they might have a slightly different swim program, which is the main thing is one less swim day a week. But actually, we've got away from that. We kind of had an informal rule/joke where if you could lead a World Series, then you didn't have to swim Thursdays anymore, which we've had several. But for example, Martin Van Riel, the Belgian, he led out Hamburg last year, but unfortunately for him, he never got the Thursdays off because it just didn't work out with the planning and what we were doing. So I think he felt a bit cheated on that. But in general, yeah, I think that just that consistency every day. So we haven't done too much of that, but there's still an individualization on the swim with respect, of course, to the appropriate intensities, and there can be a wider range of abilities in that sense of making sure they get enough rest, and whether we need to go on a different cycle, or some of them might pull more during the same set. They might do more strength work during the same set as than somebody else, whether they're sort of a puller or a swimmer, whether they need their kick, then it will depend how we manage that. The cycling probably doesn't change too much. We tend to probably do more skill based stuff or multi-sessions, like runs off the bike, with more of the women than the men in general. But it is super important to pay attention to that individuality. And probably, again, where that comes out, if I go away from the individual planning, it's being willing to change their program based on how it looks like they're adapting. So if someone is over-fatigued, or if they have a niggle or a pain, then we need to individualize in that way, so we don't stick to the program, as it were, but be willing to make the change. And being able to do that every day, or have multiple contact points a day, is where it can be really useful. And so that's where it's important to have everybody here as much as possible. It's not always possible, but everybody in that environment. So that's probably the most important thing when I reflect, as not just the swim, bike, run, or how's the training different, but being willing to change things and adapt to the individual based on how it looks like they're doing.
And when it comes to an Olympic year and qualifying, and perhaps different federations have different rules, and I don't know, take Rio and the British, they had to podium, didn't they, at the test event, and the grand final, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, both of them.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So how do you prepare in a group environment with different athletes from different countries for something like that? And is it really difficult?
Not as much as you think. I mean, I think we've kind of found a rhythm where we've been able to be pretty good through most of the season. And so I kind of focus less on peaking than sort of being good and consistently good. That said, I mean, for everyone this year, the test event is important. And for, I guess it's just one athlete, and that's Non Stanford, who's joined us this year. Also, Yokohama will be important, because the British qualification for Tokyo, you have to get a podium at Yokohama and the test event in Tokyo. And I guess that's because the grand final this year is only 2 weeks after the test event, so, and it's quite different kind of course. And Lausanne, it's quite a hilly course, and the other two are flatter, and obviously Tokyo very hot. So I guess that goes into a factor. But in terms of practicality, actually doesn't change that much still, because we want to be good in Yokohama anyway. Everyone wants to be good, and pretty much every World Series race is important in that sense. Just going off of how we've done the series since this squad started kind of post London and 2013 and beyond, we've kind of found a good rhythm about how to be, like I say, consistently good through the series. And I guess it helps that we, managing your energy through the year like that, you're probably less likely to make mistakes. And obviously, probably what's different about those events is the feeling of pressure, or the outcome on those ones really, really does matter. But I think the way I've tried to manage it is create a predictable routine into all the races, so it doesn't change very much going into a more important race, if you like. And once they get into that and get to know that, then they can expect that they'll perform more or less as they have. And and a lot of the times that's what you need to do. I mean, I guess to win an Olympic medal or a world championship medal, if you're already near the top, if you're in that medal zone, then reproducing what you've done before might be all you have to do. Of course, that's not true for everyone. I mean, some people, they really do need sort of a big step up. And for those, though, it doesn't change the process very much, though. It's still about what's the right thing for them now. What's the step in front of them? How do they get better now? And think about just what's logically in front of them rather than where they need to get to, like an external standard. And just think what's that right process for them. And in a lot of cases, though, it still comes back to being healthy on the start line and manage your energy well so that you're able to, I guess, get everything out. And probably one of the biggest challenges we see is athletes that have probably pushed too hard in training prior to reaching the start line. They've either been searching for confidence or trying to prove something to themselves, or just got carried away or didn't have the discipline to manage that energy. And then they arrive at the start line a bit cooked. So that's what we try to avoid. And I think just being consistent in this season is really important. And that's most likely to lead to great races that do have a external component like qualification.
What do you make of the British Triathlon's qualification policies? So even going back to London and then Rio and now Tokyo.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a lot of other federations have followed a little bit, but the environment has changed a little bit. The relay has created a situation where there's more desire to have discretionary ability. So because it's thought to be slightly different, that's probably a debatable point whether it's actually any different, but in terms of which athletes would be the best. However, I think the idea there is clear to me. It's you set a very high bar for early selection, and so you're undoubtedly anyone that can achieve it is deservedly on the start line, and there's no doubt about it. And so in any early selection scenario, that's a good policy, the federations leave themselves the ability to select discretionarily anyway. I think they want to avoid too low of a standard so that if there's something unusual happens in a qualifying race, then you don't end up with somebody that perhaps wasn't very consistent, or it was a one-off, or it wasn't in the right circumstances that they were able to perform. So these kind of high bar selections are more common around the world now. And like I say, ultimately, they have the ability to choose the team from a discretionary case if the athletes don't achieve the automatic bar. In the case of Rio, the two women did achieve the automatic in both, and the men didn't. And they were obviously able to make a decision then based on what they saw. But as we know, kind of almost every country now, the ones that are really internally competitive tend to have a high bar like that. And then there are others who clearly try to incentivize ensuring that the country has the quota places. And so they might emphasize ranking a little bit more. So the quota places meaning, you know, how many country places does the country end up with, whether that be two or three. And that's changed a little bit with the relay, but not substantially. And so that's sometimes incentivized in the smaller countries who are more on the bubble of qualifying all the places. So in the end, it doesn't change very much for us whether you have to be, I think the French, you have to win the test event for one of their qualification policies. The Australians, you've got to be in the top three. I'm not aware of another one that has two events this time, but again, for our process, it doesn't change very much anyway.
Will it be another Brownlee, do you think, as Olympic champion?
It's possible. I mean, I always say like the best predictor of future performance is past performance. So you never would look past somebody that's done it before. I mean, you certainly, you know, rather than someone who's never achieved that to be able to do it again. However, obviously the Brownlees have had their own challenges in the last couple of years, but I would never count them out for that, for the reason of just their history and pedigree. And I'm sure everyone, myself included, watching to see what Alistair ends up doing. from kind of his own health point of view and his focus of racing. We saw a few weeks ago Javi Gomez announced he was going to take a run at Tokyo. And yeah, we'll be curious to see what Alistair ends up doing. When he was at his best, obviously he had a huge impact on the race, not only just on the outcome, but just the way that he raced. And so we will see. But yeah, I would never count them out.
If you were coaching Ali, what would your advice be to him in terms of his goals over the next 2 years?
Right. Well, it's almost a bit late now because he, you know, working with British Triathlon a number of years ago,
yep.
Probably at the time I would have suggested some things to think about. I mean, the boys have got away with a lot of work, very early in the season, and they're both a bit stubborn in that way. And I think, you know, well, you wouldn't, obviously you've seen the success they've had. You wouldn't want to change them exactly, but I'm not surprised that slightly later in their careers they've struggled a little bit in terms of health. But now, I mean, I guess the question for Alistair is, can his body hold up to the longer distance stuff? And you know, even from the point of view of, there's two sides to the longer distance stuff. One of them, it's lower intensity, so it can be easier to manage for athletes that have health issues, particularly with running. So when you do less intensity, you perhaps can maintain your health a bit more, and that's one of the issues with short distance versus long distance. The other side is, if he wants to move up to Ironman, then he's going to have to run more, and can he do that? So, you know, whether 70.3 is the sweet spot for him now, or motivation-wise, I guess for somebody like him who's achieved so much, you got to ask, like, what's driving him still, and what can he cope with as well. So it's not an easy one. Alistair's not an easy athlete to coach. I would say he's somebody that he has a lot of input in his program, and he always has had a lot of you know, he's not been a traditionally coached athlete in that way. Neither has Johnny, really. Although obviously they've had coaches, but even from the very beginning, both of them were kind of perhaps a little bit more self-directed or greater input into what they did every day. And, you know, as opposed to some athletes that really follow a program, follow advice of, you know, one coach or another coach. And so it's a challenge for him. And I don't know what he's going to end up doing. But I will be keenly following.
Very, very diplomatic. would you like to see a sort of a Kona with a very fit Frodeno, a very fit Gomez, and a very fit Alistair Brownlee?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm a fan of the sport as well as obviously working and coaching, but I would love to see everyone have a go and especially those three, but coming from the backgrounds they do. But I guess the qualification has also changed now, and that's a challenge for being able to do more than one thing. All of the various elements of the sport have some kind of lock-in like that. Like if you want to do the World Series, it's difficult to do much else. If you want to do Ironman and Kona, you got to qualify, and you're at an advantage if you've had a decent race the year before. Or at least you used to be, in the way the point system is now. You've got to go to these regional races and earn your place. So I guess the question for any of those guys is, you know, can they do that? I mean, for sure, Frodo, as he's won before, I think he can come back anyway. But that's a part of it, is the pathway to the race. So whether we're going to see that, I don't know. I mean, I think for Javi, it depends. Sounds like Javi really wants to try for Tokyo, and whether he can combine both of those things remains to be seen. And obviously the last 2 years, he's focused more on the long distance, but wasn't able to, at least in that period of time, achieve what he wanted. So, I mean, I think we all watched the 70.3 Worlds this year, and it was a really exciting race to watch. So we'd like more of that.
Definitely. Who has surprised you the most over the past 2 years in the world of triathlon? It could be ITU, it could be 70.3, it could be Ironman. But who has surprised you the most?
That's an interesting question. My first answer is drawing a blank. I'm trying to think of who has been surprising. I mean, I guess from one point of view, and I've just had a chat with the Norwegian coach, Arald, here, the emergence of Norway beyond just Christian, who's been around a while, but you know, the sweep that they had in Bermuda was something special. And from a country that doesn't have a great long history in triathlon, certainly other endurance sports, yes, but that's been interesting to see and watch the culture that they've developed and how other athletes have come up through that. You know, another point, you know, it's not surprising, but not surprising in the least, but watching also Vicky's career over a long period of time and how consistent she's been and getting better and better and better and to obviously win the world title was, I guess, obviously I was conflicted in one respect. Obviously, I really, really wanted Katie to win. But, you know, from the point of view, when I think back, you know, there's this like 10-year meme that's been going around, you know, what were you doing 10 years ago, or show a picture. But when I think of 10 years ago, I was with British Triathlon and Vicky was there and kind of just winding up her career, or not, growing up in her career, not winding up, like finishing off, but at the starting point. And you know, the testament to progression over a period of time, because she wasn't a superstar at the beginning, but just got kind of better and better. So that was interesting, but not so much a surprise. But generally, you know, the sport is a small sport, so the sense of, like, you know, we know most of these athletes. When I prefer not to be surprised, because surprise means that they didn't have a pedigree behind them, and for most of these athletes, as they kind of grow up in the sport, you know them from when they're junior to under 23 to elite. So, I mean, some of them disappear and you don't see them again, but it's just interesting to watch the different paths that they take. You know, it'd be interesting to watch like somebody like Alex Yee, who's obviously an incredible runner. Yep. And to see what he can do. He's got, it's I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse to be such a talented young runner, of whether he wants to, what he wants to do. You know, does he want to be a runner? And you know, he won it was the British Championships last year, and at 27 something 10K. And then also has, you know, a bright future in triathlon, but he's got some developing to do to get there, and I'm sure he knows that more than anyone. So I'm curious to see how that will play out and kind of what decisions he's going to make, and we'll see where that goes.
What did you've mentioned, and we know that you did work for British Triathlon. What did you learn the most about yourself during that time?
I think, so I came from Canada before, and I guess I knew that job was going to be different, and not
like
just
more managerial, but rather than sort of hands-on coaching.
Yeah, so the British Triathlon in the years before had issues with sort of conflicts of interest and with various coaches, and that's normal because it's a really small sport, and they didn't want to be in that same position. So the head coaching role that I was doing was not a coaching role, and I was fine with that. I knew that, but I think as I grew into the role and was there, I realized it at the time anyway, it wasn't exactly what was driving me. I didn't get the same back from that, because the relationship with the athletes is different. It's probably more like what the role of a performance director is in making decisions and funding decisions and selections, and you just can't have the same kind of partnership with the athletes. And at the time, and even now, I find that really drives me and keeps my enjoyment and of the sport, and it's the thing I find most interesting, is how each relationship is different, and how you're kind of on this journey together, through the highs and lows and thick and thin, and you know, sharing in success and failures together. And so in that role, I didn't get that. And I mean, it was also probably difficult moving my whole life there. And at the time, obviously it's kind of different now. I now live in the UK still, and I have a better probably understanding of myself. But at the time, I needed that connection, and I didn't get that. It did kind of grow over time, and I did feel more connected to the athletes, but it wasn't what I realized drove me the most as a coach, and so then I decided that I couldn't do another 2 years like that, so I wanted to make the change, and so I did, and that was sort of the inception of this squad, and what I'm doing now really started then.
And I guess now you've got the mix between the sort of the national federation role, like with Italy, mm-hmm. and the sort of the private stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's pros and cons to both, and probably what drove me to be interested in if an opportunity like that came up, which it did eventually, but was like the sustainability of doing it fully privately is challenging. It's, I mean, even all of the success we were having, it's still quite challenging. I mean, I suppose it's like any business, but you've got a lot of overhead if you want to do it the way that we're doing it. So always living in hotels and traveling around, and so I always knew that the sustainability would be tricky, So a partnership like this, or working with people that could see the synergy, the mutual benefit of giving their athletes the opportunity to train with some of the best in the world, and in a way kind of sharing resources. I mean, there's some separation, but there's still a synergy there between sustaining the environment that everybody can participate in. So I think it's a good model. It's not for everyone. You have to be kind of a bit courageous to pull it off. And I think that's what has made the president of the Italian Federation has a lot of courage to make a change and to do this kind of thing. Whereas probably a lot of countries would be really worried about sort of this conflict of interest part of it, mm. you know. However, it's such a net benefit to the athletes to have the opportunity. I mean, there's no country that has such depth that we're able to really give sort of young athletes and developing athletes an opportunity to train with people. They could just learn faster, and I suppose in an existing environment, because I think almost every country in the world has a version of the same problem of not so many coaches, not so many environments, and struggling kind of with being able to provide the solution, if you like, internally, and so this is one way to manage that, and it's one direction our sport has gone. There are more squads like this that have developed, and there's different reasons why. I mean, one of them is typically you don't have many of the same country in the squad, so you don't have that sort of intra-competitiveness where you're competing for the same funding or resources. Although the British seem to get on quite well with that, and up until non-recently, it was really quite internal, and they did a good job with that. But that, you know, that's not the case in most countries, that they've struggled to have environments that meet the needs of their athletes and that challenge them in all of these ways. So so doing this kind of partnership has worked really well, and it's not without its challenges. I mean, certainly what makes a private group work is that the athletes have to choose to invest in it, and that's a really powerful decision, especially in kind of the era of greater government funding and resources that are kind of given to them. I understand both sides. I work both sides every day. Whereas, you know, you don't want athletes to sort of be entitled or expect that they, you know, should get funded for this, that, and the other, or that everyone should do things for them all the time. That can creep up on you. You know, athletes just sort of expect that they should be supported. Whereas, you know, when an athlete chooses to come into a group like this, often they also often do it and lose some amount of funding from their home federation. Mm-hmm. But they still choose to do it. And that's really taking a lot of ownership, obviously. But it's a very powerful thing when they're prepared to do that. And that's not for all levels of athletes. I mean, you've got to be a certain level to be able to be in a position to do that. But in that case, you know, taking that extra step of saying, I'm going to do this, it's not just something that's provided to me, but I'm going to invest in this and make it work, can be really powerful. And I think that's partly why the environment we have is what it is, because of that commitment of everybody. They're not there because they were forced to, or it was the option, or because they get free training camps or whatever. They're there because they want to be there, and they believe it's the right solution for them. And then so you get an environment where everyone is committed to the same thing.
You must have like the most ridiculously motivated group of people within, you know, a really, really short, really, really small geographical area. Joel, we've got some questions from listeners. So first up, you mentioned Non there, so let's start with Chantel Vermeer. It says, what's the secret to unlocking Non's potential?
I mean, I knew Non from years ago. She was just starting back when I was with British Triathlon, coming from running. But, I mean, you could see immediately, you know, and in conversations, and I have to say British Triathlon have been great and super open and sharing and supportive of her making this change and specifically with me. So we've been able to kind of figure out what she needed to do. And she wasn't far away, but I think it's one of those things where just making a change can make a big difference, especially she was in Leeds for a long time and was very successful there, massively successful. But you need to continue to evolve and change as an athlete. And that's one of the things that I think, like, it's the kind of the cliche, like, change a couple of percent, you know, and of things that she's doing, and it can make a difference, whether it be fresh kind of things from a motivation point of view or in a lot of these athletes and Non is similar, like keeping healthy, keeping consistent, and having perhaps like a different relationship, a new coaching relationship. We can put a framework around that that is just different than she had before. And hopefully we think that will be the difference, you know, for this year. Also new training partners and just that stimulus. I mean, I think when you've been around a long time as an athlete, even if something was working before, some change can be good and some freshness can be good. For example, we saw Vicky after Rio move to a new location, for example, and in Bath, and that's one way to do that. But change can be good, and I think that's partly what this is about. And what I see, I think, you know, she was obviously as former world champion and fourth place in Rio, very close to the top of the sport, and so. You know, it's subtle things. It's, you know, how we do things is a little bit different, but not too much different from what she was doing. But that little bit can make the difference in taking the next step and growing kind of with motivation and energy to approach the season in a new way and hopefully have the biggest success possible.
Kate Offord says, what's your biggest challenge as a coach at the moment? I don't know if you've just answered that one in the question before, Non.
Yeah, no, I mean, the biggest challenge is really simple. It's just continuing to try to do the basics well every day and make good decisions. For me, that's where I just try to get right is when we have decision points, and they're all the time, you know, what, you know, if somebody's tired, what do we do about that? If somebody has a niggle or pain, what do we do about that? What's the right amount? When do we need to stop them? You know, those things are continual all around us, and it's being focused and engaged to see those, especially in a bigger group. When there are many athletes around, I don't want to lose any of those decision points where we need to make a call about something. I've kind of at once both grown more confident over time to make those decisions, but you never totally escape the fact that, you know, the whole world is getting better all the time, and there's that like bits of doubt or not exactly insecurity, but you need a certain amount of questioning yourself. Are we doing enough? Are we doing the right thing? Should we be doing something different? You know, you need the balance of that versus just, you know, okay, well, we've done this before. We know what we've got. Don't want to change the formula too much, but you also can't stay in the same place. So it's, you know, that back and forth between those things and just doing the basics well every day and not trying to get too sophisticated because you think that's what, you know, is needed. It's making those decisions every day. What's going to get us to the start line healthy, consistent, and, you know, how do we improve but not change too much?
Talking of change, Lynette Warren says, what's the biggest change in your coaching philosophy over the years, or has it stayed the same?
What I alluded to before or said before was being more confident to make decisions to leave things out. Earlier, you know, in my coaching career, when I think of the worst mistakes that I've made, it was always not trusting my instincts or just doing too much and kind of knowing that that was happening, but not being able to stop it or willing to stop it. You know, from happening, you know, like, because athletes are motivated, they want to do more, they want to be confident and feel that they've done the maximum they can do. But over time, I've kind of tried to focus more on that of trusting my instincts, trusting what I can see, and trying to manage that. Also, I mean, the athlete needs to learn how to manage it, but also I have to be willing to step in and manage that, and grow more confident in that. And I think one of the advantages we have, if we have any advantage in terms of our environment, is the, when you've had some success, you can reflect on what you did to achieve that. And I think our way of working and having sort of, again, control over everything in terms of intensity has been good. And yeah, I have to remind myself of that, you know, that we don't need to sort of keep up with the Norwegians or the French or whomever. That's not the point. The point is to do the right thing for the athlete at the right time and what's in front of us. So that's a change, I guess, in terms of growing more confident. The process hasn't changed too much, but it's subtle things. I mean, even the last 2 years, we've changed how we do our swim program and the balance between the amount of solid race pace work versus sprint work, and you know, we've changed that. We've changed how we manage the interaction between the three sports together. That's something that's evolved a lot. And as the courses have become different, the bike courses in particular, we've had to adapt our training a little bit and the mix between the three. So that's a constantly evolving thing, but it's not a huge change year to year, but small things, and they can make the difference.
Final question from Mick Simpson. What's the biggest mistake you see regularly from age groupers?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's only age groupers, but simply just biting off more than they can chew, pushing too hard. I mean, I think, you know, again, it's a theme of a lot of how I think about things, but like doing the right amount and not more than that. And okay, that's not easy necessarily to know yourself or to figure, you have to figure that out at times, but it's, you don't need to finish every workout kind of at the limit. And in the sense that we want to be, again, and anybody that's doing sport, you want to be able to be consistent over time. You don't want to, you know, make yourself ill or affecting your health by pushing too hard. And so I think having that discipline is really important, and being able to manage yourself in that way so that you're not just like expressing your ego in training and smashing yourself because you think that's what it's about. If you just enjoy that, then that's one thing. But if you want to race well and achieve your potential in competition, then you've got to manage your energy over the course of the week, over the course of the month, and through the season. And that's how you can be successful when you want.
Brilliant. So Joel, is the Real Coaching Podcast going to be back regularly again?
I'm definitely interested in bringing it back. So we did the first one of 2 years last week. I did enjoy the feedback and the comments. I think it's a very small niche, I think, of people that are interested in I2 racing and the kind of that high performance side. But I did enjoy the interaction and comments from people all around. And I had a surprising number of people that asked me about it over the last 2 years, if it was coming back. And it's probably like the same three people, but it made an impact on me. A former athlete of mine, Gregor Buchholz, a German fellow who's got a podcast, which he started. I did a short interview with him last week, and I thought, you know, I really do need to get this going again. And I had been doing it with a colleague, Paulo Souza, and it was difficult to coordinate between us, so that'd be one of my excuses. But the reality is this ITU business, especially, I don't do really very much age group coaching or online coaching anymore. So, I'm not trying to grow business in that way, but I do enjoy sharing and talking about my process, what we're doing. Or just yesterday, I had a really interesting chat with the Norwegian head coach, and we're going to put that out as a podcast this week. So it's like anything. I feel like when you have to convey information or talk about what you're doing, it's useful for you as well. If there's some selfish reason to do it, it's to help formulate my own thoughts about where I'm at, what am I doing, and also to share that, because there's not so much of that going on in the triathlon world, at least in the ITU focused side of things.
I think it's kind of therapeutic, so I reckon go for it. Do as much as you can.
I've got also an assistant coach called Drew Box, who's here to help me coordinate some of this stuff. So that's also useful. And I think also what I did recognize, like, we're kind of at a unique point where we've got all these great athletes here and not necessarily sharing some of that. I think something could be missing. I was sort of motivated to share that process now, also as a record of what we were doing. And so we'll see where it goes, but I do enjoy it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed the chat, Helen.
There you go, Robert. Nice.
Cracking stuff. He's the man,
nice,
isn't he?
Nice short interview there with Joel Filliol.
That apparently thought you're never going to get away from each other. It sounded like you were just going to keep chatting forever.
Well, I there were so many more questions I wanted to ask.
But
thank you very much for everyone who sent in a question as well for Joel. Yeah, just really, really good to have Joel on and hear about everything ahead of Tokyo 2020 and everything else that we chatted about.
Great stuff. Okay, let's jump over and into Coach's Couch this week, sponsored by TeamOxygenAddict.com Triathlon Coaching.
So the question comes in from Mick Simpson, who says, I'm looking for some advice on duathlon pacing, run and percentage of FTP on the bike. And the distance is a standard. So 10K run, 40K bike, and a 5K run for the second one.
Topical, with us having the British Duathlon Champs mentioned earlier on today, which is really good. And I think this is a great question for people racing duathlon at this time of year, because it's tempting to look at the numbers and go, right, well, I've got a 10K, then a 40K, and then a 5K. So I'm going to try and do the 10K just a bit slower than my 10K pace, the bike section just a little bit slower than I would at a time trial, and then the 5K, I'll give it everything I've got at the end.
If I have everything left, or exactly. Anything left. Yeah.
And that's fine, because at least you've got a strategy. It's not the one I'm going to suggest, but at least you've got a strategy. Then the problem is, on race day, everyone lines up, the gun goes off, and people cover the first half mile at their 400-meter flat-out pace. Get all excited by the fact that, you know, we always talk about the importance of pacing, but it's even more so detrimental to you to get that wrong in a duathlon than in a triathlon, because at least in a triathlon, when the fast swimmers go, you don't see them anymore. In a duathlon, the fast runners in the group are really going to skew your perception of how fast everyone's going. So the first thing you're going to do is whatever pace you're going to decide to run at, use your pace monitor on your GPS watch to really stick to that to start with, because almost everybody's going to go off much faster than they mean to. And it'll really pay you back double dividends in the 5K at the end if you can control your pacing at the start. Now, that being said, the approach I go with pacing for duathlons is whatever the combined distance of the two runs are, find out what your best case scenario to run that would be in a flat out run race and shoot for that as your run pace for the 10K. So in this case, it's going to be a 15 kilometer run. So I would say to somebody, well, if you were doing a 10 mile road race, what pace would you run at for that? And the pace tends to be significantly slower than they would do for a 10 miler. So for example, to take my kind of numbers when I was racing, I'd do a 10K at about 5:30 a mile, maybe 5:35 a mile. So I could have done the 10K at 5:45 a mile and felt like I was slowing down quite a bit. But the combined time, if I was racing over 15K or 10 miles, would have been closer to 6 minutes a mile. So I'd really hold myself back in that first 10K. Sorry, that's my Skype running in the background. I'd really hold myself back in that first 10K. So I'd be running kind of 20 seconds a mile slower than I could do. So it really feels as though you're really, really not really going that fast at all, especially relative to...
Yeah, and everyone's going away from you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But it totally pays you back dividends on that last 5K because everyone's given it all they've got, but most people are just completely destroyed. And what you'll find is if you do pace it right, the measure of that is if you can make the 5K at the end the same pace as the 10K at the start, you've done a really good job, because most people are not going to be able to hold that pace. Then in terms of the 40K bike leg, you want to be looking to be somewhere, between 90 to 95% of FTP. So we're significantly under what you'd be riding at 40K time trial on the bike. It's probably, in terms of pacing wise, it's probably going to feel a bit more like a half Ironman effort than an Olympic distance effort, if I'm honest. So again, that feeling of holding yourself back on the bike is really going to allow you to give it the beans on that final run, because that run's going to be horrible even if you pace it right. And if you've blown yourself up completely, it's just going to be utter misery. So we're going with a combined pace on the run of whatever your best case scenario for the combined distance of the run was, and then about 90 to 95% of FTP. And what I would say on the bike is, the fitter you are, the higher percentage of the FTP you can hold. So our kind of race leader type athletes are going to be at the 95% end. Our more middle of the pack age group athletes are going to be shooting for 90% of FTP.
Are you a duathlon fan, Rob?
I always felt like I wanted to be. From a run bike background, I always felt like I should have been enjoying them. I always found them to be much less enjoyable than a triathlon, bizarrely.
Because it just felt like so much pain.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. Because I found to have any success at it, that was the pacing strategy that worked for me. And it felt like the first run, you know, when I went, we'll take Ballbuster for an example, I think I was about 85th into transition on the first run. So it felt as though, am I doing right here? And then I was in sort of eighth place or something into transition two. So I know I got the pacing right, but I didn't find that a very satisfying race experience, if you know what I mean. Whereas with the triathlons, I think I enjoyed the head down nature of the swim, where you don't really know where you are and you get out and then you zoom through people on the bike. I think the people who win duathlons enjoy racing the run at the front and kind of hanging on for dear life. Everyone else finds it utter misery. How about yourself?
I've done a few. I've done the Alton Park, and then I did Storm the Castle, which was my first one. And that I really, really enjoyed, but I think that was partly the course and it was tough. And I just really enjoyed that as an event.
Yeah.
Probably a lot more than the Alton Park, which is sort of laps and circuits and really not that interesting compared to, you know, an off-road run, which sort of goes above a town, you're climbing and then you drop down, and then like the bike's out in beautiful countryside.
Yeah, exactly.
I quite like swimming, so oh, there's a surprise. So I quite like triathlon. Yeah.
It's funny though, isn't it, that even though I always preferred the running and the biking, the running especially, I always found the combination of run, bike, run. I always felt so good on the last run of a triathlon, but always felt so terrible on the last run of a duathlon.
Yeah.
That it was almost like the thing I always enjoyed, running past people, just didn't happen. It was just a gritted sufferfest. Just get me to. And every time I remember thinking, I remember how this feels. I'm never doing another one of these. So for the people out there who love them, good on you.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think though as well, does this sound really silly? Do you think you get even better runners in giraffe? Does that sound obvious?
Definitely.
Does that sound stupid?
No,
I don't know.
That's a very good point that I think people, it goes back to that thing about the pacing mistake at the start. Lots of runners enter duathlons who don't enter triathlons.
Correct. That's
and
what
so,
I mean.
You know, it's not uncommon when you do an Alton Park that there's some young lad who's 18 years old and entered his first duathlon and he runs a 31-minute 10K and you don't catch him till the end of the bike and he's riding like his granddad's steel thing with toe caps on. And you're like, how have you stayed ahead of me till this point when I've got all this expensive Cervelo? And the answer is he's just such a good runner.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so usually whereby in a triathlon, it was, if it was, you know, a 5K or a 10K in a triathlon, the pace that you might, I don't know, the sort of pace that you might do there compared to what other people in a duathlon would be able to run, like, they're just like minutes faster than you.
Yeah, I think that triathletes, when they're racing runners in a triathlon, it's more equalized because the runners have got the legs smashed in by the bike. Whereas at the start of a duathlon, obviously they're fresh and they're going to destroy us. So, yeah.
There you go.
There we go. Good stuff. So listen, if you're after a bit of inspiration for your winter training, if you follow the link in the show notes, we've got a download of a free 4-week training plan from Team Oxygen Addict that you can jump in and give it a try, and it'll get your training back on track if you've dipped a little bit too much into the Terry's chocolate over the Christmas and New Year period. Give that a go. Just follow the link in the show notes from there.
Great. Should we do some news, Rob?
Yeah, what's been going on in the world, Hells?
So a few little bits of news. Bahrain Endurance 13 team, they have announced a few new members. So Vincent Louis. Then Christian Blumenfeld is going to be on the team.
Favorite, yeah.
Yeah, and Lauren Parker as well, who we spoke to ahead of the Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast last year. She went on to win the bronze medal. Fantastic athlete, fantastic story. If you have not heard the interview with Lauren Parker, go and listen to that. So yeah, Bahrain Endurance 13 are very much now aiming to get winners at Tokyo 2020 through the Olympics and the Paralympics, which is pretty interesting.
It's
so hence
great
those
to see them expanding to sponsor paratriathletes as well.
Yeah,
it's a real
exactly.
positive move, isn't it?
Yeah, and what there are fewer better role models out there than Lauren Parker.
Yeah, good stuff.
Other bit of news, Rob, is that Long Course Weekend Mallorca has added a half distance as well. So that's from the 26th to the 28th of October. So rather than just like the sort of iron distance, you could go and do maybe a 1.9k swim, a 86k bike and a 21k run over the weekend if you wanted to.
Nice. That'd be a nice end to the season, I think. I've always fancied going out to Mallorca to do that and been intimidated by running a marathon at the end of it. But I think
do you not
running...
remember seeing the weather from this
year?
Yes,
I know. Yeah. I'm nervous because I've got a week booked in Mallorca in about 3 weeks' time. So I'm trying not to think about that and just going, it'll be sunny.
Aren't you Fuerteventura?
I'm going there at the end of March.
Oh, you've got a double whammy.
I've got a double whammy, yeah.
Oh my God.
It's not a full week in Mallorca. I got one of those ridiculously cheap flights for 4 or 5 days or something. So it was one of those. Yeah, go on then. Why not?
Nice.
Long weekend in Mallorca.
Nice. Well, I'm sure you get bluer skies than here.
Well, and also the flights are cheaper than the petrol to drive to see my mum and dad in Blackpool at the moment. It's like 50 quid return to Mallorca.
That's like the Sardinia thing.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 So there
good. We go.
All right, Hals, I believe you've got a little bit of an exciting trail of a future episode for us to come up.
Yeah. So in 2 weeks' time, we are going to have a special episode of the podcast.
Tell us about it, please.
Oh, I thought we were just going to play the trail there.
All right, go on then. Well, we'll just play the trail. Here we go then. Here's a trail of Helen's special.
With menopause, it really isn't discussed. Like vaginal dryness, what? Who's talking about that? I don't want to know.
It's not like when you have a period and you know you're going to get it every month. It doesn't work like that when you're menopausal.
The narrative around the menopause is that women are sour, that they're grumpy, that they're sweaty, that they're sexless, that they're dried up or had.
It's constant up and down.
It can be okay, and it can be a time in life when women feel actually feel like on a watershed and quite empowered. But I do know that for some women it can actually be horrendous. And I remember as a GP just seeing women who had no idea what was going on, but just didn't feel well.
But it is something that happens and people need to talk about it because then there are better solutions.
Yep, so Rob, we're going to have a whole special podcast on the menopause. So I've spoken to a number of age group athletes. I've spoken to Dr. Stacey Sims, the author of Raw. And I guess the idea is a little bit like the podcast Blood, Sweat and Gears that we did about periods in August. It got lots of people talking. Loads of people got in touch afterwards, you know, saying, wow, thank you for doing this.
Different, isn't it? Something that's been covered elsewhere and something that isn't talked about enough. And it's something that came up at the Training Peaks conference, where in the Q&A, there were a lot of questions from the female participants in the audience saying, you know, we need to raise awareness around different issues that affect women and not just men in what's traditionally been a male-dominated sport. So I'm really glad that you've done this. I think it's going to be super interesting for us men to listen to and go, didn't know any of this.
Well, I think actually that, okay, yeah, that's part of it. But actually, it might also help to, right, so I'm younger than sort of perimenopause age at the moment. So it's been very educational for me. But it might explain why, if there is a, you know, if your wife or whatever, or your partner,
mum,
yeah,
whoever,
is sort of perhaps just not feeling herself, not acting herself, you know, one day feels great, another day feels awful, feeling tired midway through the week, whatever. Actually, if you listen to this, you might kind of think, oh,
yeah,
okay, that would explain it.
Yeah,
you know?
Interesting.
So hopefully it will help educate anyone who's listening to it. It certainly educated me whilst I was doing it. So
good.
Yeah, and just help people talk about these kind of things, especially because I know a lot more now is being talked about with the menopause. But I think when you're such a sort of sporty person, or activity is so important in your life, then when you go through something like perimenopause and the menopause, and it alters what, you know, how you feel doing all of these things, then you're not alone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing it, Hels.
Cool. Thank you.
Good stuff. Thanks.
And Rob, can I do one other thing and then I'm going to shut up?
Yeah.
Can I just say thank you so much to Jill Fullen and Bedford Harriers, who basically sold a load of Fueled by More Cake books, or purchased a load of Fueled by More Cake books. Jill said, Helen, no worries. I'm going to get rid of a load for you at the club, you know, annual awards due. And she sold over 20 books, which is
great.
Oh,
nice work, Jill.
Thank you very much to everyone at Bedford Harriers who has got a copy of the book.
Great stuff. All right, well, let's wrap it up then. Thanks very much to our sponsors this week, precisionhydration.com, teamoxygenaddict.com and fueledbycake.com. We'll be back next week with a fantastic interview with Terenzo Bazzoni, who I just got off the Skype with interviewing a minute ago. It's brilliant, Hels. He is such an inspiration and such a positive character after him being basically hit and run by a logging truck back in July. The story of his comeback to win Ironman Western Australia about a month ago is just mind-blowing. And it's easy for us to look at the headline figure and go, oh, Tarendo's come back from injury and won again. Brilliant. But the story of what he's gone through to get back is just mind-blowing. So tune in next week to have a listen to that. And yeah, until then, everyone, get out in the sun if you get the chance and get a bit of inspiration training out there. Winter's hopefully drawing to a close. Spring's on the way. Get out there and give it some. So until next week, I'm Coach Rob Wilby.
I'm Helen Murray.
You've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. Until next week, everyone, have a great, safe training and racing week, and we'll speak to you all again soon. Thanks, everyone. See ya.